Hey, San Diego. It's Andrew Bracken in for Jade Hindman. Today, we hear about the state of NIL and its impact on college sports. This is KPBS Midday Edition, connecting our communities through conversation. Should college athletes be paid? Are they students or professionals? These are questions that have been debated for decades before lawsuits led to NIL deals for many college sports stars. That's name, image, and likeness, and it's at the heart of a transformation in college athletics in recent years. But universities, athletes, and fans are awaiting a final ruling to a long-running lawsuit that could change the rules for college sports. Kimya Massey is the executive director of athletics at the University of San Diego. He spoke to KPBS Midday Edition host Jade Hindman last week. Here's that interview.
To start, can you explain what this term NIL is and how it's impacted college athletics?
I mean, how long do we have for this interview?
Right.
Because this could be hours and hours. No, it's a really good question. I appreciate you having me on to talk about it. It's really important that the general public understands what this is, where we've been, where we're headed. You know, NIL now has been around almost 4 years, and it's really changed the landscape of college athletics. And it's been a long time coming in terms of allowing the athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness the way any student has been able to for many years. And, you know, I think many of us in the industry saw a lot of different rabbit holes on where this could go, and how it has gone has been a little bit exactly like we thought. And it's gone a little bit, frankly, off the rails. We live on the West Coast, and it is the true wild, wild west. And in some ways, it's a complete mess. That being said, there are some values. There are some good things about it that I'm sure we'll talk about.
Well, Kimya, when you say that that these college athletes are able to profit off of their name and likeness, what does that look like?
Yeah, probably the easiest way to explain this is, for example, if a student athlete was a, you know, really good baseball player, and he wanted to do camps. In the past, they couldn't use their status as a collegiate student athlete to do a camp and be paid for it, knowing what their status was as an active member of a roster on a collegiate team. Now they can do a camp. You know, they can make a public appearance and be paid for it. They can be a part of a social media campaign and promote a business or an organization and be paid for their time and efforts. In the past, that was not the case yet. A student who was a great piano player could be paid to go to downtown San Diego and play at a event and be paid $500 for their 3 hours of playing. You know, that was not the case for an athlete. And now we're in a situation where it's equitable, where now they can do things that other students could do for years. But it's really gone off the rails in terms of the pay for play side of things that we're unfortunately seeing.
Right. So, you know, to make it plain, college athletes are now able to get paid for their work. And it's a bit more equitable. So how has it gone off the rails?
You know, there's a market out there, specifically around football and basketball, more particularly, that there's a lot of money, and a lot of the athletes are now being poached. Essentially, they're being recruited out of high school, recruited from one school to the next. There's some guardrails, but probably a lack of a real structure. And every year, you're seeing, specifically in men's basketball, rosters turn over by half or more because athletes have, you know, feel like they have value to go somewhere else and get paid more money. And it's really challenging to control this. And I think there's a lack of structure in terms of how do we manage the expectations of the athletes. But also there's, I would say, a lot of bad actors out there who are not really helping the athletes in terms of being consultants and guides and agents. And it's really gotten to a point where it becomes this bartering zone of one school to a next school, trying to have a roster, but also still get the right kids at the right institution who want to get a degree. Feels like that's where I'd say going off the rails.
Yeah. So right now it's equitable for athletes, not so much for colleges.
Yeah. It's just really hard. You know, when you are building something special on your roster and you're trying to build chemistry, and ultimately we want all our athletes to get degrees, and many of them now are looking at a 1 year scenario where maybe they go somewhere for a year and they play really well, which is great. And now they're more marketable, and now they're heading to the next institution. So I think we're trying to figure out how do we still keep the higher ed principles, because we are working for institutions of higher education, still in place while really negotiating a scenario where it's very much like a professional sports organization and it's a business. And what's that juxtaposition between the two, and how do we still keep the integrity of what we're trying to accomplish with 18 to 23 year olds?
You know, one piece you touched on there is the ability for athletes to move to a different school when in the past they were kind of tied to a school, right? I mean, how do you find a balance there?
Yeah, it's a tough balance. I think a lot of high school athletes, right, came to school for they wanted to get a business degree, they wanted to play for a certain coach, they want to be geographically close to where their family is so they can see them play. And I feel like a lot of that now is a little bit gone by the wayside. It's okay, I'm going to go to this place because I can get playing time and increase my value. And again, I do want to say this. This is not the norm. I mean, there's a certain percentage of athletes in this case. The vast majority are still coming to school for the right reasons. They want to get a great degree. They want to have a good college experience. They are coming to have that collegial opportunity to win championships. But there is a subsection of athletes that where it's really hard to really find that true identity of why they're coming to the institution and how do we build that identity with that within that team.
Okay, well, all of that leads to this settlement that's currently being finalized. I mean, can you break this case down?
Yeah, I'll do the best I can in layman's terms. Essentially, this settlement is the culmination of multiple lawsuits, mostly hinging around the fact that athletes for years did not profit off their name, image, and likeness. And, looking at the culmination of what the lawsuits might lead to in terms of both dollars and time, plaintiffs decided along with the NCAA, let's do a settlement that's going to allow something to have come in place where there's some back pay for former athletes up to a certain number of years. But also moving forward, it does allow institutions to essentially do revenue sharing with the current athletes. So it's twofold. In addition to that, probably the most controversial piece of this settlement is that there are now going to be roster limits in place for each team and each program. So that typically outside of for most sports has not been the case. So now there's going to be a roster limit. Essentially, we can share revenue with athletes, and then there's going to be a back pay for athletes for who did not profit off their name, image, and likeness. So that's in a nutshell. This settlement would be in place for 10 years, and that's what we are sort of trying to navigate what this actually looks like as we move forward.
So, one question a lot of people have is, how did we get here with college athletics? What was the spirit behind this push for NIL deals in college sports?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think this has been a long time coming. And I think if you look back at the early 2000s, you saw a proliferation of coaches' salaries, administrator salaries. You saw a lot more money being tied into the conferences in terms of multimedia rights. Conferences started to profit from TV deals, and that filtered down, of course, to the institutions. And it came a point in time where I think a lot of the athletes and others said, "Wait a second, these institutions are profiting off of us and making millions of dollars in some cases, and we're not getting paid anything, although they were on scholarship and getting paid through, with food and things of that nature." But through a culmination of many years, I think there was a groundswell really that probably became untenable to the point where we get to where we are now, where in 2021 this NIL became in play, and this has been probably 15 to 20 years, if not more, in the making though, because there is such a proliferation of money being involved, and it did feel like you were becoming a little bit more professionalized, specifically in a few sports. And the question is, why were we not sharing this with the athletes? So that's sort of why we came to where we are. Being someone who's been in college athletics 24 years, I wish earlier on in the process, years and years ago, there was some kind of revenue sharing. There was the ability for the athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness. And I don't think we'd be where we are. It's a runaway train. And I think we could have maybe started this as slowly and built it and put some guardrails around it. But here we are, and we have to figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, but I recall hearing a story about a college athlete who had his name and image and likeness and all of that on jerseys and all kinds of things, but couldn't afford to even buy a jersey for himself. So, you know, I mean, how much, so let's talk about it. I mean, how much were you, are universities making off of these athletes and teams?
You know, it really depends on the institution. You know, there's a lot of different types of institutions. I think that's another one of the challenges in Division I. You know, there's 360 plus different institutions, and they range from budgets that are $5 or $6 million up to, you know, the Texases and Ohio States of the world who are well over $200 million, and they're literally all in the same division with the same amount of same rules. So it really depends also on the conference. You know, some conferences, specifically what we call the Power Four now, the SEC, the Big 12, the ACC, and the Big 10 are at a level that's just much higher. And even within that four, the SEC and Big 10 are at a different level than the other two. So many of these institutions are getting a significant amount of funds on multimedia rights that come to their institution every single year. And, you know, we've just gone through a cycle of some of those conference distributions changing. You'll see another one coming up here in 2028 to 29, 2030. So the shifting is underfoot, and it's happening rapidly. But in some cases, it's very significant. In other cases, it's not a big distribution. You know, there isn't maybe a large market, or perhaps they don't have a football program that brings in a lot of money, or a basketball program that does. So it's quite a significant gap between many schools that are still in the same division, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. How much are players making right now? How big are these NIL deals?
Yeah, you know, the vast majority are actually not that big. You're talking seven, maybe a couple hundred bucks. That's the vast majority. But you do have cases now where you have certain quarterbacks or point guards or centers and people like that making literally in the millions. And, you know, you might have a few other student athletes who might not be as successful on the court or on the field, but they're social media influencers and they're doing really, really well. I think about Libby Dunn, who was a gymnast at LSU, and Angel Reese, who played basketball there. You know, there's some good examples of people who've used their social media influence in a really creative entrepreneurial way and made a ton of money. And then you have the cases with some of the men's basketball and football players, and a few of the women's basketball players as well, who based on their on-court, on-field exploits have had valuations in the millions as well. So it's, again, that's probably the 1% or 2%. The vast majority, much, much less. And frankly, there's probably, you know, a high percentage of athletes not engaging in NIL activities at all. It takes time. It takes energy. It takes a creative spirit. And some are very, very busy with their studies and being a college athlete as it is. So I think the narrative from the media a lot of times is that everybody's earning hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. That is very far from the truth.
How has this impacted the competitiveness of various sports? Let's say college basketball.
Yeah, I think you do see some parity now, a little bit more parity. You don't see someone just three or four or five schools that are just way better than everybody else. I think you're seeing institutions that have had, frankly, large budgets, and they're able to pay athletes better than others, and that's going to help them. But also you see athletes who maybe started at a large institution that's a high-profile school, and they didn't get playing time, and they're good players, but now they're transferring down a level to a school that's still Division I, but maybe it's what we call a mid-major or smaller institution. And you find that players are staying in school even longer. And we got through COVID and they had an extra year there. And some athletes who are not draft prospects, instead of trying to declare for a draft, they say, well, I can actually make more money in college now. I'm staying in college. So you're seeing rosters get older. You're seeing more individual athletes who've had more experience. So you're seeing a little bit more parity, I think, in the college basketball and maybe football to an extent than you did before, which is not bad for the game. So I think we'll see over time. It's only been a few years, but it's been really interesting to see some of the talent actually being leveled out in certain ways on different rosters at different size schools.
And has this had an impact on other collegiate sports, like maybe rowing or lacrosse?
Not so much. You know, I think there are quite a few sports where there's been very, very little impact. You're starting to see it creep into other sports like baseball, volleyball, for sure, a little bit softball. You know, you have a softball player for Texas Tech. She's reportedly making $1 million plus a year. Sometimes you don't know what's true, what's not true, but a lot of the quote unquote Olympic sports have been less impacted. And I think part of that's due to what is deemed market value and their non-revenue sports. But occasionally you will see the athlete who, again, is very good on social media. They're influencers. they're really good at selling their name, image, and likeness and utilizing that skill set in an entrepreneurial way. But you are seeing some impacts in some other sports that you didn't see probably 2 or 3 years ago.
What role does the NCAA play in all this?
Yeah, they're involved. Clearly, I mean, they're part of the settlement, you know, and I think they've come to the decision, and I'm not going to speak for their president of the NCAA or their director, but, you know, they've been a part of this house settlement, and they feel like there is still a little bit of protections here for amateurism, but also over the next 10 years, potentially maybe less lawsuits. I don't know if that's the case. I would probably beg to differ. But, you know, I think they're, frankly, in some ways, you know, working with the plaintiffs on this and trying to determine what's the best possible path forward that still retains the integrity of what collegiate sport is. And again, we are in institutions of higher ed, yet allowing some flexibility for athletes to profit and sort of, again, move towards a professional model, but not truly as an employee. So there's this fine line and balance. But yes, they've been very much at the table for all these discussions.
So how do you see your school, USD, fitting into this new landscape for college sports?
Yeah, we're in an interesting space. And honestly, too, you know, as a private school, I think we do have some advantages at times because we can really help enrollment in a private school the way maybe a public institution is a little bit different. You know, we are in a place in a very stable conference, the West Coast Conference, and you know, we have to be who we are. We're not the same as a lot of Power Four schools, and we're not going to have that kind of budget or revenue that to share. We don't have a football program that's selling out on Saturdays, providing 70% of the revenue like some of those institutions do. So I think we have to temper expectations, but also be transparent about what our revenue sharing looks like and how we can compete. And I think part of us being where we're at is understanding culturally how we can still bring in the right student athletes to the institution who can still get a degree at an academically rigorous school, a school that's a faith-based institution, but also in a large city that has a great marketplace for sports. You know, I do think optimistically we can be extremely successful and very competitive, even with schools that are larger than us and have larger budgets. But I do think we have to be more careful and more considerate of finding the right fit for our athletes here, in the midst of all the chaos that's going on around us.
I've been speaking with Kim Yamassi. He is the Executive Director of Athletics at the University of San Diego. Kim, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, anytime. I really appreciate you having me.
That's our show for today. I'm Andrew Bracken. KPBS Midday Edition airs on KPBS FM weekdays at noon, again at 8 p.m. You can find past episodes at kpbs.org or wherever you listen. Thanks again for listening. Have a great day.